much out of King George, Virginia. This is what I'm talking about. And you know what I did in the break? I went and subscribed to Zateo because a free press is not free. So that's what you got to do for PFW. Tell your friends about WPFW and Democracy Now. Keep the calls coming. 800-222-9739. You heard Mehdi Hassan's words. You heard how they're torturing. You can, you know, whatever viewpoint you hold it. But they are torturing students for simply speaking the truth, for simply saying genocide is wrong. Is this the country we want? No. But if we want the country we want to live in, we need a free press. We need Democracy Now. We need WPFW. 800-222-9739. WPFWFM.org. Please keep the calls coming. E. Ethelbert, the esteemed E. Ethelbert Miller, is up next with On the Margin. And please keep the support going all day long for WPFW. We need you. We love you. We love you and we appreciate you. You understand what solidarity looks like. You understand what standing up and using your voice, your power looks like. And we thank you. You're in tune to WPFW Washington.
Welcome to On the Margin with E. Ethelbert Miller. My guest today is John Dinges. John Dinges is the author of Chile in Their Hearts, the untold story of two Americans who went missing after the coup. Dinges is also the author of The Condor Years, How Pinochet and His Allies Brought Terrorism to Three Continents. How are you doing this morning, John?
I'm great, Matthew. It's good to see you.
Always good to see you. And this is a fundraising drive going on right now, as Katia was saying earlier. And I'm encouraging our listeners to call 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739. Those are the numbers that if you want to make a pledge and support us here at WPFW. John Dinges, take us back to September 1970. Talk about why the election of Salvador Allende was so important, and what did his election mean to Chile as well as other nations in our hemisphere?
So September 1970, I was working as a copy editor at the Des Moines Tribune in Iowa. And I was working, I think it was a Saturday, and I was putting together the paper and writing the headlines for the front page. And one of the stories that we put on the front page was a Marxist is a victor in Chile. And the story was Salvador Allende, the president of Chile, elected president of Chile, who was a Democrat, not Democratic Party, but a certified Democrat whose country had 100 years of uninterrupted democracy, and he was elected with a coalition of the left and the center to bring radical social change, but democratic social change. This inspired a generation of young people all over the world. I start the book talking about the 20,000 foreigners who flocked to Chile in 1970, 1971, to be there for the process. We called it the process, el proceso. Many of us from the United States went to Chile with the idea that we were going to continue the social revolution that we had tried to bring about in the United States. Many of us were veterans of the civil rights movement. All of us were in the anti-war movement, which in 1970, Nixon had been elected, and we were discouraged. Chile was this shining light on the hill, inspiring us. And if you spoke a little Spanish, or if you wanted to speak Spanish, you headed to South America. It was by far, I was a journalist, a young journalist, with a couple of years experience working at the paper in Iowa. I was a police reporter. And I wanted to be a foreign correspondent, and I had my political ideas. I was a true journalist. I wanted to report the facts, but my politics were pretty front and center back then. I kind of had to learn that you can't really do politics at the same time You can't let your politics influence the way you look for the facts.
You know, when you talk about this excitement that people had for Chile, it reminds me of what happened after Kwame Nkrumah came in to being president of Ghana. You know, this whole thing of independence, you know, and how people were, African Americans were inspired, that people wanted to go to Ghana to work, you know, to build this independent African nation. And it seems that that happens every generation or two. A country becomes a beacon for hope.
Yeah, and the people in South America were looking to Chile as a model for the future. They thought that this idea that you could combine socialist values, a government-directed economy, that would combine capitalism and free enterprise with state enterprises, and international solidarity, that this would overcome poverty. It would provide a way of doing business, of doing capitalism that was human oriented rather than profit oriented. It was a great ideal. It was
when you say that, John. Right, and I'm coming back and looking at the other side. That seems that would scare people as much as Fidel Castro taking over Cuba.
Well, you're putting your finger on it, Ethelbert, because who was scared? Henry Kissinger was scared. And I wouldn't say maybe Henry Kissinger doesn't get scared. He gets determined. He sees this little country down there that's strung out along the east coast, the west coast of South America. And he says, what is this Marxist doing down there? And, well, he's a problem. He's going to bring Fidel Castro's communism to Latin America, and it's going to spread around. And why is it going to spread? Because Fidel Castro was a communist. He had an authoritarian regime. But in Chile, he was elected by the people. Mm-hmm. And so he had credibility. These are what I've, you know, garnered from the documents written by Henry Kissinger in his memos to Nixon. We have got to make sure this experiment in South America does not succeed, because if it succeeds, it will be a model and all these countries will want to do something similar. And we're afraid that this will be worse than Fidel Castro because it has more credibility.
Let's go back and talk about, you were talking about how many people were attracted to what was going on in Chile. Let's deal with Charles and Frank in terms of the two characters in your book who decide they want to go to Chile. Give us an example of who they are and why they both went.
Sure. Charles Horman was a journalist like me at the beginning of his career. He had actually was working for a business magazine in New York City called Innovation. He had been trained on the West Coast for a couple of years doing TV documentaries. This is really the beginning of TV documentaries. And he was by a long way from being a radical, but he was a progressive. He was somebody, he had, for example, Charles Horman had gone to Louisiana in 1963, before the voters movement, to the voter registration movement, or in the early days of it. He had gone down there to register voters in the South. He was arrested and beat up in Louisiana. And after he got out of jail, they kicked him out of town, and he and his friend, they went to Washington, D.C., and were in the March on Washington in August 1973. And Charles had this idea. He was a thinker, an intellectual, and he was a pool shark. He was somebody, in fact, he got arrested because in this Louisiana town, he went into the pool hall to have a beer, like midday, with his friend, and there was some pool tables, and he won some money off the locals. And they were so happy that they grabbed their beers and they walked out into the streets to see what was happening. And the cops, one of his friend was black, And the cops went up to him and said, "Hey, you guys, you can't drink beer. Didn't you know it's illegal?" And they arrested him for carrying a glass of beer on the streets. So, you know, he kind of tells this matter-of-factly, right, that they get taken in there. They said, "Wait, college boy, what are you doing down here? And how come you're here with this friend? Who's your friend?" "Their friend's from Louisiana, right? You guys aren't making trouble." There were 100 cops roaming around the streets because there had been a demonstration the day before. You know this situation. Mm-hmm. This was everyday life in the South. But Charles Horman, the thing I want to point out, this was a year before you had this massive movement of students from the North coming down to help register people in the South. I guess you could say he was always on the cusp of things, but not as a great leader. He just was thinking through things, understanding things, kind of like a journalist, and he wanted to be where the action was. Mm-hmm. So he goes down to Chile in that way. Now, Frank Teruggi is very different. Frank Teruggi comes from a working class family in Illinois, near Chicago. He's born in Des Plaines. His father was a union member, a member of the teletype union. So that means he, you know, worked in print shops and he's a teletype operator. I identify with that because I was very much part of that when I was a young journalist, right? Frank, as a student, goes to California, goes to 3 colleges in 3 years. He's, you know, he hasn't figured out what he's going to do in life. He goes from like a technical at Caltech. He was great in physics, but he didn't really like that. And he moves to sociology and then to economics at Berkeley. And then he quits. He drops out because he's heard about Allende and he wants to go to Chile. So he goes and works in the post office for a year so that he can earn money and learn Spanish. And he's back in Chicago. He buys his ticket. He takes the cheapest ticket he can to go from Miami. He hitchhikes to Miami, takes the cheap ticket from Miami to Bogota, Colombia, and then gets on a bus to go another. And by the way, if your listeners don't know, from Bogota, Colombia to Santiago is about 3,000 miles, right? And he gets there and joins a volunteer brigade to go work with campesinos, the peasants in the south of Chile, doing volunteer work. This is what you did when you arrived in Allende's Chile. You wanted to contribute, to participate in the process.
I want to make a connection between, before we, and I'll bring continue, I want to make a connection between Frank, because Frank is also motivated by liberation theology, okay? You, John, at one time in Austria, you were thinking about becoming a Catholic priest, you know? So I'm looking at you being a journalist, but it also seems that your concern might come from a spiritual core.
That's true, and that's true for Frank as well. And it was common. Liberation theology was the idea that that the church, that the message of the church, that the message of Jesus Christ, to care for those that are weakest, should be the social doctrine that the church should put out for society.
This seems to begin with, if I'm not mistaken, this begins with Pope John the 23rd, with the Second Vatican Council. I mean, we got a selection of a pope going on right now, but you know what happens is that these popes, you know, have sometimes set things in motion as a different way of looking at religion and spirituality.
And in the 1960s, Pope John the 23rd started the Second Vatican Council. At the same time, in South America, the bishops got together in Colombia and came out with a statement of that became the basis of liberation theology.
Okay,
in other words,
that
the church, the bishops and the priests should be helping the people to organize to improve their lives.
Okay, trying to improve our lives. I'm going to invite Katia Sitz. Katia, are you there? we'll go from the bishops to the queens, okay?
This morning. Shucks, look at that. Trying to improve our lives, that's right. Right. And the lives of our listeners, Ethelbert, which is what you do every Thursday morning. Another great program. I'm learning so much. The number to call from you and your guests, especially your guests, and the enlightenment about Chile. And I think about Burkina Faso right now, how we're all very excited about what's happening there with Ibrahim Traoré giving us that hope that your guests talked about. So we ask you right now, if you are a fan of literature, if you are an appointment listener to On the Margin, as many of us are, now is the time to make that call, that pledge of affirmation, that pledge of resistance, really, because it is the easiest way to resist what's happening in this country by ensuring that we have a free press. We have a station where a program like On the Margin can be heard with authors from all walks of life, covering all or writing about all sorts of things. And always consistently excellent quality in the discussion, in the writings. So now is the time, 800-222-9739, WPFWFM.org are the ways to connect. We want to make this goal for Ethelbert, for him to invite me back next week. You know, if we don't make the goal, I don't get to share this space with him. So help. I would say help me help you. But in a way, that is true. Help me help you. And you're helping me as well by making that call that makes the difference. $500 to go. 800-222-9739. Really, you must support that which supports you. And On the Margin does that intellectually, spiritually. We understand that being informed, being enlightened, being educated is a wonderful thing. And it's a beautiful thing when you get this from the airwaves. It's like a university of the air. So you take it all in, and your part is to pledge your support. 800-222-9739. We do want to thank Rima Ali out of San Juan, Puerto Rico, saying keep it up and keep hope alive. That's right, Rima. And you can follow Rima's lead by going online to WPFWFM.org or by calling 800-222-9739. $500 to go, Ethelbert. And I'm looking forward to thanking people with you on the other side.
Okay. All right. So I'm talking to John Dingus this morning. He's the author of Chile in Their Hearts, the untold story of two Americans who went missing after the coup. John, you were in Chile from 1972 to 1976. What were you witness to, and did you ever feel that your life was threatened because you were a journalist?
Well, Ethelbert, I have to say that, first of all, I'm going to call up WPFW right after this call and make my contribution. So I hope everybody else does the same thing.
Okay, thank you.
So I arrived down there in 1972 in October, I knew that this place was going to change my life, and it of course turned out that it did. I stayed there for 6 years, 1 year during the revolutionary period of Salvador Allende. I was there for the military coup in September 1973, and for personal and professional reasons, I decided to stay on, whereas almost every other American and all the other foreigners either were driven out of the country, put in jail, or fled because of the repression. But I had a certain protection, and I stayed on as a journalist, and actually really did my best work during the years of the dictatorship. During Allende, it was an incredibly exciting time. It was a lot of fun. All of these foreigners were around. You mentioned that I studied for theology in Austria. In the first month I was in Santiago, I ran into a classmate of mine from Innsbruck, Austria, at the Catholic University at a film festival. There were probably 20,000 foreigners in Chile supporting in solidarity with the Allende government. Many of them were exiles from other countries in Latin America because dictatorships had started to spread in Latin America. And many of them were from Europe and from the United States. this large group of people from the United States, progressives from the United States, included Frank and Charlie. And we were friends. We hung out. We hung out with the Latin Americans. We did volunteer work together. And the group around Charlie and Frank, they created a newsletter because they thought, I wasn't involved in it, but they thought that it was important to provide information to the Chileans about what the progressive movement was doing in the United States. We, as you know, we called it the movement. It was radical politics. It was change society. And it was support international movements outside the country. And they were their first issue had a story about Angela Davis, right? The American communist leader. It was a great experiment. And their idea was, we're not going to tell Chileans what to think. We're going to tell them what is happening outside of Chile for their information. And this was, these were, everybody had a project. Everybody wanted to contribute something. I compare it to the international brigades that supported the Republic of Spain at the time of the Spanish Civil War. And I quote Pablo Neruda, who wrote a book of poetry about the Civil War in Spain and talked about the international brigades. Of course, the situation is somewhat different, but the idea of international internationalists, internacionalistas, coming to a country and supporting the good cause, the cause of liberation theology, the cause of revolution, to help the poor, to return land to the campesinos. This was very much of the ethos. This was the inspiration that we all had.
But let me ask you this question, John Dingus. When I read your work, and I also read the novels and essays by Ariel Dorfman, it seems that you guys write in an attempt to sort of maybe revisit the past to understand it better. But it also seems that perhaps you both suffer from what I call trauma and to some extent guilt and the inability to do more.
I've never considered myself to be suffering from guilt about this. Trauma, yes. I've written three books, a kind of trilogy, as John Lee Anderson from the New York.
Well, let me mention the guilt. The guilt I was thinking of, and this comes in maybe more from maybe Errol Dorfman than you.
Yeah.
The whole thing in terms of survivor guilt, like you know, I survive, and all my friends are gone.
I know that Ariel talks about that. That's never been a thought that's been in my mind. He was a Chilean. And he was working in the government. He could have been arrested. What the killings that broke out, hundreds of people, about 900 people were killed in the first month. They were friends of his. It was people around him in the government. I never focused that kind of attention on myself. I even though two Americans were killed, Frank and Charlie, I did not think that that was going to happen to me. I was angry. I was outraged. But I wasn't, the victims were not people like me. And I never want to put myself in that position. My attitude was, I'm going to tell the truth about what's happening. And that's why I stayed on.
Mm-hmm. Well, talking about the truth, and we'll, I have you ask this question, and then we'll take a little break in terms of identification. How much is the U.S. involved in terms of the actual September 11, 1973 coup? And you, as an investigative journalist, you start dealing with, okay, I'm going to document to see whether there is proof or there isn't.
Yeah, on the question of whether the United States was involved in the coup. That's generally, at the time, we were aware of the tremendous destabilization program that the United States was carrying out. There was a kind of international blockade to prevent them from getting World Bank credits and international loans. There was a lot of clandestine work that the CIA was doing to foment opposition. They were paying political parties, including the Christian Democratic Party. All of these things I'm kind of collapsing in terms of when we learned them. We were only half aware of this during the Allende government, but we definitely suspected that the CIA and the United States was involved in undermining the Allende government. So there was great suspicion. Obviously, then when the military coup happens, the first thing we all thought was it must have been the United States that was behind this. Now, I have been researching this for many, many years, and we now have a very complete set of records from the time, U.S. records that have been declassified. So the record is much, it's much more complicated than, oh, the CIA did it. The CIA actually was involved in a military coup to try to prevent, in 1970, to try to prevent Salvador Allende from actually being inaugurated after he was elected. That was Henry Kissinger's brainchild. And we actually financed it. We organized some military people and some civilian people. And the result was an assassination of the head of the armed forces in Chile. The United States has really never paid the accountability for that, what we did at that time. We were directly responsible for fomenting that coup, which was unsuccessful, but resulted in the assassination of the head of Chile's armed forces.
Right. Let me ask you a question. I'm glad you brought that out, because in your book, and I'm looking at what happens, you know, in terms of when Jimmy Carter comes in, because you have a statement by Hiding Carter, you know, and it was a sense in terms of, I remember Jimmy Carter talking about human rights and things of that sort. And it seems that perhaps under the Carter administration, they should have did more of an investigation.
Yeah. So there were two coup attempts. You know, one was successful in 1973. The one in 1970 was fomented by the CIA and was unsuccessful. The 1973 coup was carried out by the Chilean military by themselves, some support from Brazil. The United States was not directly involved in that. It's important to put that on the record. Now, the United States becomes the primary defender and supporter of this Pinochet dictatorship. And we defended them from the international criticism that was cascading against Chile because they were killing hundreds of people, because there were mass prisons. Now, I continued my reporting through 1976, the assassination in Washington of Orlando Letelier. I'm still there in 1977 when Carter is inaugurated, and things changed significantly. The United States was now a supporter of human rights, not a defender of the human rights violators. It's an important to point that out. But as you began your question, Hiding Carter, somebody who I admired, like many of us did, I have documents showing that he passed up the opportunity to tell the truth about what happened to Charles Horman and Frank Tarucci. The United States was almost as official policy hiding the fact that we knew that it was the Chilean military that had murdered two Americans. The official policy of the State Department was, we don't know what happened. There are reports that they were killed by leftists masquerading in army uniforms, in stolen army uniforms. A ridiculous, absurd scenario. But that was what the United States was putting out as the possible explanation of what happened. It might not have been the Chilean military. Oh my, who knows what really happened? And we hear that there's these stories of the fake troops who might have killed them. That position that we can't say who killed these two Americans was maintained through all of the administrations from 1973 on, including the Carter administration.
Well, we're going to take a little break. My guest today is John Dingus. We were talking about his book, Chile in Their Hearts, The Untold Story of Two Americans Who Went Missing After the Coup. The show's On the Margin. My name is E. Ethelbert Miller. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
This is your social justice calendar for the week of May 5th, 2025. Thursday, May 8th, the Institute for Policy Studies invites you to a talk and book signing with author Carolyn Woods Eisenberg in conversation with IPS fellow Phyllis Bennis, featuring her new book, Fire and Rain, Nixon, Kissinger, and the Wars in Southeast Asia, at the Institute for Policy Studies, 1301 Connecticut Avenue, Northwest DC, from 12:30 to 2 p.m. More info and RSVP is requested on ips-dc.org/events. On Thursday, May 8th, from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m., Africa World Now Project and Bloom Bars present the award-winning film on racism, colonial exploitation, and migration, Pieces the Identities, by Congolese filmmaker Mweze Nganura at Bloom Bars, 3222 11th Street, Northwest Washington, D.C. More info at www.bloombars.com. On Sunday, May 11th, from 7 to 9 p.m., the continued series of Malcolm X, the film screening of Malcolm X, Make It Plain, will be held at Sankofa Video Books and Cafe, 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C. For more info, visit sankofa.com. WPFW's Social Justice Calendar connects you to grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. This is due by Thursday at 5 p.m., at least 1 week in advance of your event. Please donate to WPFW for our spring pledge drive by calling 202-588-9739. 202-588-9739. Cash App at $WPFWFM or going to WPFWFM.org and clicking the donate button. WPFW's Social Justice Calendar helps build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Okay, we're back on the margin, and we're here during our fundraising drive. The number, once again, is 202-588-9739, 202-588-9739. Katia, did you want to say anything?
You gave the number. I just want to let people – thank you for that. I just want to let people know that we are still in need of $500 this morning. Won't you get us started? This is an important conversation, a riveting conversation. But take a moment out of listening and make that call or that click that makes the difference. 800-222-9739. $500 to go.
Okay. John, in 1982, the movie Missing is released. Jack Lemmon, Sissy Spacek is in that movie. The movie receives many Oscar nominations. If you, John Dinges, was a movie critic instead of an investigative reporter, what did you think of this movie?
Well, I actually wrote a review of it with Saul Landau, with whom I wrote a book on the Letelier assassination. And we said that the movie gave an accurate and compelling description of the terror that we all felt at the time, if you were living in Chile at the time of the coup. It was an incredibly powerful movie. The story of the coup, of the fear in the streets, of the mistreatment of people, the mass arrests, that was all very true to life. I take issue with, I guess I should state, at the time, I believed the premise of the movie. I thought it made sense. The movie portrays the idea that the father, Ed Horman, went down to Chile to search for his son.
That's Jack Lemmon.
Jack Lemmon, mm-hmm. Yes. And he teams up with Sissy Spacek, who plays Joyce Horman, who was called Beth in the movie, Charlie's wife. And they try to find Charlie, who has been missing for a month. And they eventually become convinced that the U.S. Embassy is hiding something. And in fact, they were. There was information the embassy had that they had not turned over to them. They suspect, the family suspect, that the Chileans, of course, had killed him. And the embassy is saying, oh, no, maybe he's in hiding. We have a journalist here, somebody who told us that he's in the Underground Railroad. They're taking him out of the country. Maybe he'll be safe in a few days. The family was then discovers the body. The bodies are the Horman's body is discovered in the morgue after a month, and they go home and they tell the world, we think that the United States was hiding something. We think that perhaps how could the Chileans have killed him without telling the U.S. about it. We think that they might even have been involved. So the movie leaves you with the impression that Charles Horman was killed with the approval, if not the instigation, of the United States government. That's the part of the movie, the premise of the movie that I investigate. I thought I was going to end up confirming, finding the evidence of U.S. involvement. I had access to all of the U.S. documents. I had access to the 7,000-page Chilean court record, which
and you released. Also and you also have access to a very key individual. Talk about Rafael Gonzalez.
So the Rafael Gonzalez was an intelligence officer who worked for the Chileans. He had worked in New York, spoke perfect English. And Rafael Gonzalez gives an interview to a journalist named Frank Manises, a friend of mine, and in 1976. And he says, I have information about the Horman case, about Charles Horman. He was killed because he knew too much. And it was done between the Chilean military and the CIA. So he makes this accusation that seems to confirm what the family suspected. I tell the story of where he got that information. But the astounding thing is that 20 years later, Rafael Gonzalez completely retracts the story that he told in 1976. And he says, it was a complete falsehood. I made it up because I was in a difficult situation. I was in the Italian embassy. I had defected from the Chilean government, from the Chilean military, and I was trying to get out of the country. And I thought giving this interview would attract attention to my case. He was there with his wife and his 8-year-old child. And so I tell the story of where he got the information to invent the story about Charles Horman. He got it from a newspaper, the London Times. And he tells me this whole story in interviews. But more important, he issued a 5-page retraction in 2001, which he then submits to the court in 2003, in which he completely not only retracts his story, but says the circumstances of where he got the information, which I was able to confirm, and why he did it.
Well, let's talk about that because you're an investigative reporter. So somebody retracts it. You still have to say, okay, well, this guy lied the first time because he'd be lying the second time or whatever.
Exactly.
So how do you really find out that this is the second one is what's going on?
So when somebody tells a story and then takes it back, you can't just say, oh, well, you can't just willy-nilly choose which one you want to believe. You have to look at the facts and see which part of the story has corroboration and which part doesn't make sense. So that's what I did. And finding the retraction was very, very important. So and of course, you have to read the book to really understand my investigation and the basis for my conclusion. My conclusion is that he was telling the truth when he retracted the story. And the reason that I give credibility to that is because I'm able to corroborate that part of his story. Because I have the article that he used, and I can see where he got the idea of Horman as the man who knew too much. Mm-hmm. The other part of his story, that when he makes the accusation saying it was the CIA that was involved in killing him, that part has never had any corroboration. He never told anybody about it in 1973, and he only comes up with that story in 1976 when he meets with these two journalists. So one part of the story, then there's other details about his story that are hard to put together because he's in different parts.
Let's look at you, okay, Dingus. In terms of you come across as this, I'm wondering how people who are on the left see you, because it seems like, okay, you mean the CIA is not involved, and you know, it seems as if you're justifying U.S. policy.
Yeah, absolutely, Ethelbert. And when I set out to write this book, to do an investigation, I actually was going to do a TV documentary. I thought that I was going to find the evidence to prove that the U.S. was involved, because for the first time, I was going to have access to the court records. And the court records, you know, the court concluded that the U.S. was involved. And so if the court said it in Chile, I thought the evidence must be there. And so I went through 17 volumes of court records looking for the evidence. And I found, instead of the evidence that the CIA did it, I found the evidence that the story falls apart. The retraction was there in the records, although the judge neglected to mention it in his verdict. Now, but let me talk about the politics of this. The left had a great deal of investment in this story that the CIA did it. It was part of a campaign by the family to a certain extent. Many people believed it. I believed it. I'm sure you believed it. People thought that it made sense, and they had this witness who said that it was true. When I reached my conclusion after doing my investigation, realized that the evidence is simply not there. To the contrary, there is evidence that this was an invention, that this was a fabrication by this guy, Rafael Gonzalez, and there's no other evidence besides him pointing in this direction. When I started talking about this to friends on the left, some of them said, "Don't rock the boat, John. Don't change the story. Why do you want to go into this thing after all these years and change what we have always believed?" But other friends told me the opposite. You know, they said, you know, we have to set the record straight. We can't build political movements around things that are actually a lie.
Well, let me ask you this question, because this is my critique of your book. I'm going to give you my critique. I see what's happening with you talking about Charlie and his death. But it seems after there's a point where Frank gets lost in your book.
Frank gets lost?
Yeah, it seems like more focus because it's a movie about Charlie. It seems like sure.
Let me explain that.
Okay, go ahead.
The reason that this book, that this story became so famous is because of the movie. The movie pays almost no attention to Frank's story. Mm-hmm. There's one scene where you meet Frank. He's a totally different person from who Frank really was. He's like this arrogant, hotshot guy who, you know, there's a scene in which Joyce sees his body in the morgue. That's all you hear about Frank in the movie. In reality, what the difference between the two cases is that Charlie was missing. His body I document this in my book, was actually being hidden. Officials were intervening in the morgue to make sure that the normal process of identifying bodies did not happen in the case of Charlie. That didn't happen in the case of Frank. Frank's body was identified within 2 days at the morgue, and the U.S. consulate delayed for a week in telling the family that his body, that Frank actually had been found. But as far as the process of identification conducted by the Chilean bureaucrats, that went on normally, and he was found very quickly. His body was returned to the United States. The story that I tell of Frank, it's definitely, he's not lost in the book. The political story of Frank and his connection to the leftist movement, the MIR, the movement of the revolutionary left, is a very important part of the story. The politics of what he was involved in, his friends, he was more political in many ways than Charlie Horman was. Charlie actually took more risks than Frank did. So if I have debunked the story that it was the U.S. that did all this stuff, I have to say, well, what really did happen? Right. And that's the bulk of the investigation, to tell the story of the activities that would have put both Frank and Charlie at risk and may have led to their detention and ultimately to their execution.
So, Charles, John Dinkins, talk about what begins to happen in 1990 and what role did the National Commission of Truth and Reconciliation play?
The thing that is really important to understand about Chile is that it has 17 years of dictatorship, 3,296 people who were killed and disappeared during the dictatorship. And the crimes of the dictatorship were incredibly well documented. When democracy returns in 1990, within a year and a half, there was a complete documentation, not complete, but a very extensive documentation of many, many of the deaths. The reason that they could do that was that, including Charlie and Frank, and the conclusion that they had been killed by agents of the state. The reason they could do that with such precision is because all during the dictatorship, there were people working to document the crimes of the dictatorship. And this was led by the church and protected by the church, but the people that were doing it were people of all faiths and no faith. They were doing the groundwork, the dangerous work of documenting the crimes. And so, and I say this with some emphasis because we're going through a period in which authoritarianism is taking over the country. I'm sure on WPFW people are not doubting what is really happening in the country. I take it very, very seriously. I think we are going to be in a situation equivalent to the dictatorship of Chile within several years if things are not stopped. And what people did, if you read about what happened in Chile, you can see the path forward to recovering from a dictatorship. And I think that's one of the reasons people should study the case of Chile. And one of the things that was so important was that people, even when they were not hopeful that they could recover, that they could overthrow the dictatorships, they did the grunt work of forming political coalitions, of documenting the crimes so democracy could return. And when it did return, they were able to document what happened.
Well, John Dinkins, you just gave a good explanation of why we should have WPFW. Katia, are you there?
I'm right here. And absolutely. Thank you, John, for that perfect segue. Really, I mean, we heard Mehdi Hassan say it earlier, free press is not free. And the way that we stay at least unembedded and not under their thumb, even though we're in their sights, is through your support. You all have sustained WPFW for over 48 years. You have sustained this program in particular on the margin beautifully. And E. Ethelbert Miller does such fine work bringing you an array of authors that you often don't hear other places. And so we ask you to pledge that support now. We want to say thank you to Anonymous out of Annandale, Virginia. Thank you so much. And they are saying, great show. The only place on the airwaves where you can hear the historical truth, which is so true. And today we are definitely hearing that regarding the Chilean coup. And they also say, stay strong. Thank you. And Philip Mussenden out of Silver Spring, Maryland, also giving a generous support. So again, the number to call, we have 375 to go. Not very long to do it, 12 minutes, but we can do it. We can even exceed the goal. Ethelbert, we've seen it happen. The number to call is 800-222-9739, 800-222-9739, WPFWFM.org if you prefer to go to the website, $375 to make the goal for On the Margin and E. Ethelbert Miller.
John Dinkins, who I'm talking to, he's the author of Chile and Their Hearts, The Untold Story of Two Americans Who Went Missing After the Coup. John, one of the things I wanted to know about, what's the state of the Santiago National Stadium?
Soccer games occur regularly. It's still the place that people.
So it wasn't turned. It wasn't turned into like a museum or something like that, or.
No, it definitely would not. It's still a soccer stadium. There is a part of the museum, there's a part of the stadium that you can go and you can see an exhibit about the way it was used as a mass prison. 7,000 people were held in there in the first weeks after the coup. And many people were executed, not in the stadium, but taken out, executed, and dumped in the streets. It was primarily workers and poor people. The repression was, and of course, people from the government, but the target of the repression was the mass movement. It wasn't just the leaders. And that's why they used such a such massive tactics. They would go in and raid factories. They would individualize all of the leaders and put them in trucks and take them to the stadium. And they would sit there. Some of them would be executed either before they arrived at the stadium or after they were interrogated under torture at the stadium. It was a horrible, horrible scene. Frank Teruggi was held at the stadium for 3 days. Charlie was held at the stadium for only overnight and was killed the next morning very quickly, and then his body was disappeared. Frank was, I have the account of people that Frank talked to while he was being tortured, while he was in the stadium, and was saying, you know, if you get out, talking to other prisoners, if you get out, tell them it's not just Latin Americans and Chileans, that there are North Americans in here, and I'm sure the embassy will come to help me. And of course, that didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And I tell the story how it should have, but it did not happen.
You know, when I think about how I met you, John, I want to ask you about the Institute for Policy Studies, because it seems as if IPS played such a key role in terms of, you know, bringing Pinochet to trial, to justice. But it seems as if that, and maybe I'm looking at the book that you did with Saul Lando, because, you know, Assassination Embassy Row. But talk about IPS and Chile and your involvement with both with the organization.
So when I came back from Chile in 1978, within 24 hours, I met Saul Landau. And I had been writing about the assassination of Orlando Letelier from Chile because it was very much in the news, and I was identified with it because of my stories. And Saul offered to, he said, let's write a book together. And that's how I became a book writer. Saul has always been my mentor, my political conscience, and my ideal. Saul worked for IPS, the Institute for Policy Studies, where Orlando Letelier was a fellow. And so that was the connection to IPS. I myself was not involved directly with IPS, although we had an office, Saul and I had an office at IPS where we did much of the research for the book, Assassination on Embassy Row.
Well, I would like to, as we come to the end, I recall... you at the embassy, and shows you how the times changes and how one has to continue struggling. But you received like one of the highest awards that I think Chile would give out to a non-Chilean person in terms of your work is so important to the history of Chile. Okay. We just mentioned that because we got a.
Yeah, it's the Order of Bernardo O'Higgins. It's up here in my bookshelf. It's a medal, a gold painted medal, I guess, in the order of commander.
Okay, right, so I'm gonna call you from now on, Sir John Dingus. Okay, but we have to have a wrap in terms of. I want to thank you, John, for being on my show. you know, and encourage people to read Chile in Their Hearts, the untold story of two Americans who went missing after the coup. So thank you once again. I think I'm going to give a few minutes for Katia to do a final pitch before we go off the air. But thank you, John, in terms of, you know, I've admired you. I enjoy going to baseball games with you. And I continue to realize that the work that you do is so very, very important. And I'm glad that you caution us about what we need to be concerned about here in our own country.
Yeah, thank you for having me on, Ethelbert. We'll go to a baseball game, but the most important work is to stand up to the creeping authoritarianism that's coming in this country. And right. That's what I learned from my books.
Okay. Katia?
Wow, that's such a perfect ending. Thank you, John. This book is amazing. And of course, I think many of us will be reading it. Thank you so much. And Ethelbert, of course, thank you for another wonderful show. And I know there are many out there that are also, they were glued. they're transfixed. They could not move listening to this information that's coming out. And again, this historical knowledge, this historical truth today that we heard about the coup in Chile, and of course the U.S. implications once again. And John gave us the warning about the creeping authoritarianism. This is what we're talking about today. And Ethelbert Miller, you know, he is the mastermind. He is the producer of such wonderful programming here through On the Margin. So please, the number to call, 800-222-9739, 800-222-9739, $375 a go. Consider becoming a sustaining member, taking that whole chunk and dividing it up over a year's time in monthly increments. You can do that. You just need to call 800-222-9739. Maybe there are two sustaining members out there, or you can also do it online at WPFWFM.org. Please, we still have time for Ethelbert to make his goal. He usually does. You all are usually wonderful in coming through. Don't let today be different. Thank you so much, Ethelbert.
Okay, I'm getting ready to leave, Christina.
I know.
Okay.
Okay. The calls will keep coming.
Okay. And many blessings to everyone. Okay.
The WPFW local station board will host a town hall meeting on Saturday, May 17th, from noon to 2:30 p.m. at the New Bethany Baptist Church, 1300 10th Street Northwest in Washington, D.C. Our theme is WPFW, Still We Rise. Featured speakers include representatives from station management, the Pacifica National Board, our programmers, and LSB volunteers. Listeners are invited to learn about new initiatives, finances, our search for a new home, and more celebrations as we continue in our 48th year of operation. If you cannot attend in person, you can tune in via Zoom. Details will be posted soon on the WPFW website. Through turbulence, transitions, and triumphs, Still We Rise as a community-powered radio station uplifting peace, justice, cultural expression, and the music that moves us. We look forward to adding your voice to WPFW for the unheard, as a rhythm for the people, and a light in times of darkness.
In celebration of the life and legacy of activist and composer Bernice Johnson Regan, Wise Regan Arts and Strathmore presents Over My Head, I Hear Music in the Air, a night of song, poetry, and reflection, featuring Toshi Regan with special guests Liz Wright, Alexis Pauline Gums, original members of the Freedom Singers, and more. Friday, May 16th at the Strathmore. Information at strathmore.org.
I'm Janelle Anderson. I've been listening to WPFW since the 80s. It has helped manage my lifestyle, and that listening to health programs turn me away from the hormone antibiotic meats. I've been a pescatarian since I had my girls listen to WPFW on the way to school, and that I believe they became organizers for justice. One co-founded a justice club in her high school, and another helped organize demonstrations. And I think today they are the better for just listening to those morning programs. I love the diverse format, from jazz to inspirational to talk. The programming has really grown me, and for those reasons and more, I support WPFW.
WPFW has been a site of resistance in defense of truth, justice, and culture for 48 years. Our spring membership drive begins with a special celebration of James Brown's birthday, May 3rd, and closes with a centennial birthday celebration of Malcolm X on May 19th. Two pillars of music and message. Your financial sustenance is needed more than ever to continue this type of programming. As a new listener or current member, this is your opportunity to contribute to the growth of an institution that stands resolute against both gross injustice and repression and the mass erasure of history and culture by amplifying